And we turn now to a very different debate, one touched off by Yahoo. Yahoo sent out an email to its employees last week telling them they may no longer work from home. The policy change was made, the email explained, to enhance collaboration in the workplace. Yahoo's CEO, Marissa Meyer, who is famously a new mother, drew fierce criticism from those who say she should embrace rather than reject flexible work arrangements. We're going to explore pros and cons of telecommuting in today's Business Bottom Line. NPR's Yuki Noguchi asked some experts about what's lost and what's gained when people work from home.
Jerry Davis noticed that his University of Michigan colleagues got most of their work done during Free Food Fridays at the office. Lunch is the bait and shop talk the byproduct. That sort of workplace dynamic is Davis's area of study.
One of the places that we studied, the coffee machine, seemed to be the central holy site holding the whole place together.
Davis, a business professor, says what you miss in telecommuting is the, oh, I'd been meaning to ask you, conversations that turn into something more.
It's more efficient, but you lose that serendipity.
Davis says he himself has had those moments. When he was donating blood, a political science professor lay on the gurney next to him, and that discussion eventually turned into some scholarly research. And he suspects it's that serendipity that Yahoo is trying to recreate by summoning workers back into the office.
The random interactions that people have turn out to be potentially quite consequential.
Is it possible to measure what that happenstance interaction really generates in terms of innovation or productivity?
Yes. Funny you should ask.
Davis is now studying a group of scientists that recently started working under the same roof. He says those whose daily paths tended to cross at the elevator or copier also tend to collaborate more often. John Challenger is CEO of outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas. He says tech companies were early adopters of telecommuting and are now finding the practice sometimes goes too far. But he says it's interesting that this edict is coming from an internet company that offers email and instant messaging.
So much irony here. Not only is this high-tech company that's been at the forefront of the technology that's changed how we work now asking workers to come back in, but also it's a 37-year-old mother who is seeing the advantages of being able to balance her work life and her personal life by telecommuting and yet saying, for the good of the company, we can't do this. We have to change.
Many people say Yahoo CEO Meyer is missing the point and missing an opportunity to set an example as one of the few prominent women in technology. One of them is Cindy Auten, general manager at Mobile Work Exchange, a group that helps government and business clients design telework programs. She says telecommuting requires putting trust in your employees. And if you can't do that, she says, you've got other problems.
One of the things telework will expose is issues in your management.
Auten says the fear is that telecommuters may just eat snacks and watch cat videos all day. But in fact, properly managed, telework often exposes unproductive workers.
You know, a lot of cases from a management standpoint is if somebody wants to telework, it's forcing a conversation that you might need to have with that employee or have needed to have a long time ago.
Yahoo itself said in a statement, this isn't a broad industry view on working from home. It added, this is about what is right for Yahoo right now. In clamping down on remote work, Yahoo is going against the grain. The Family and Work Institute, a research nonprofit, says the number of employers who allow telecommuting has more than doubled since 2005. Ellen Galinsky is president of that group.
We can't just assume that we're in an industrial command and control work environment anymore.
Galinsky says companies that don't recognize this do so at their peril. She says they risk becoming less productive because today's top talent values flexibility even more than money. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. has made it through gas shortages and the credit crunch. Now, tech industry insiders are warning that the country is headed for a critical shortage of computer programmers. NPR's Steve Henn reports that a new nonprofit is launching this week, backed by some big tech names, hoping to close the gap by getting kids excited about coding.
Since 2004, the number of U.S. students graduating from college with computer science degrees has fallen by roughly 30%. Hadi Partovia is a tech entrepreneur who also invested in Facebook. He says if graduation rates plateau at this level, over the next decade, something like
1 million more jobs are going to be created than there are students graduating from our colleges studying to fill those jobs.
And you don't have to take Partovi's word for it. His numbers are based on Commerce Department projections.
And these are among the highest paying jobs in the country. If you add up all those jobs, it adds up to about $500 billion worth of salaries and economic value for our country.
So Partovi helped found Code.org. The group's first goal is to get more kids, all kinds of kids, excited about coding as a possible career.
Great coders are today's rock stars.
It's enlisted celebrities like Will.i.am. The group launched a website to help kids find programming classes in their own neighborhoods. And they've produced a movie to help explain what coders actually do. Turns out most programmers don't work for tech companies. If you want to write songs, cure cancer, or build race cars, coding helps. Leslie Chilcott made the film.
I tried to interview a lot of people that would break the myth of the stereotype that still exists of the nerd programmer in a dark corner with pizza boxes piled up and crushed soda cans, you know, coding for 36 hours without a break, and all of these things that just aren't really true anymore.
Still, Code.org has some high-profile geeks as backers. In the film, guys like Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates talk about how they started programming.
The best early thing was actually using software to decide when the classes in my school would meet, and that put me in a position to decide which girls were in my class.
But lots of folks in this film don't fit into this nerdy boy genius stereotype.
You don't have to be a genius to code. Do you have to be a genius to read?
Bronwyn Grimes designs video games at Valve. And then there's Chris Bosch from the Miami Heat. He majored in computer science.
When I was in school, I was in this after-school group called the Whiz Kids. And when people found out, they laughed at me and, you know, all these things. And I'm like, man, I don't care. I think it's cool. And, you know, I'm learning a lot. And some of my friends have jobs.
But Code.org found most school districts don't even teach computer science. Hadi Partovi hopes his group will change that. And he's convinced that in the 21st century, learning code will become as useful and frankly, as necessary as learning to read. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
With unemployment still high, managers continue to be inundated by applications. Some big companies are coping with the deluge by using talent management software. It winnows pools of job applicants before a human ever lays eyes on the resumes. Human resources people say in today's economy, those systems, which have been around for decades, are crucial. But job hunters often find the software overly aggressive. From Minnesota Public Radio, Annie Baxter reports.
Even though Tim Woodfield works in IT, he's probably not rooting for computers to take over the world. They didn't exactly do him any favors when they reviewed his resume. Woodfield was out of work for about a year and applied for dozens of IT management positions in the Twin Cities. Talking at a job networking event, he said his resume often failed to make it past companies' software systems. The software typically screens for keywords from a job description.
If there's 25 bullet points, you got to hit all 25. So if you miss one or two, they're going to catch on it and somebody else is going to get the interview.
Forget the old days when you'd print your application materials on nice thick resume paper and mail them in. These days, you usually apply online. At the start of the process, you create an account. And then you might be asked questions like, can you lift 50 pounds? Or are you a convicted felon? If the software overlords are satisfied with your answers, you can submit your resume. If the right skills are there, the software will then rank you against other candidates. If not, you'll likely get an auto-generated email rejecting your application. Tim Woodfield tried to outwit the software with another software program. It's called Wordle, and it can identify the key concepts from job descriptions. Woodfield would then front-load keywords like project management and IT infrastructure into his resume. He and other job seekers complain the candidate management software creates too many hoops to jump through.
There's no way possible you can have all the buzzwords, or your resume is 6 pages long.
Woodfield ended up getting a job the old-fashioned way, through networking. HR types like Elaine Orler, a talent acquisition consultant in San Diego, say candidate management software can be really helpful for big companies that can afford it. Several years into the economic recovery, unemployment's still high and companies have limited open positions.
Where they used to hire 10, they can only hire 2 in this economy. You've now got 1,000 people fighting for 2. By default, more people will be rejected.
And many of those applicants are totally unqualified. Ann Costello is a recruiter at Vention Finance in a Minneapolis suburb. She thinks the requirements for drawing unemployment benefits, which include applying for multiple jobs, are causing people to go on application sprees. Costello sees bartenders and line cooks vying for high-level accounting jobs. She figures it's because they're looking to check the box on their unemployment paperwork that shows they're trying to get a job.
I was opening up these resumes and just shaking my head because, you know, it requires a college degree. I probably got 20 applicants who don't have a college degree.
In those cases, Costello says candidate management software is helpful. But she concedes it may sometimes cut too deep into the talent pool, eliminating qualified candidates who just didn't use the right buzzwords.
How can you get to a point where you feel like you're screening out the people you don't want to see and not the people you do? And there's no perfect answer for that because it's a computer.
But Costello notes humans are fallible too. If hiring managers had to sit down and sort through hundreds of applications by hand, they actually might not fare much better. For NPR News, I'm Annie Baxter in St. Paul.
NPR's business news starts with a shakeup at Groupon. The CEO of the online discount site Groupon has been pushed out from the company he founded. Andrew Mason's ouster came a day after the company reported worse than expected losses. NPR's Laura Seidel reports that Mason's exit is no surprise.
Groupon's stock value has been on a steady decline since its IPO in November of 2011. It's gone from $20 a share to below $5. CEO Mason was known to be a bit of an eccentric, and his last day was no exception. He posted a letter online that said, quote, "I've decided I'd like to spend more time with my family. Just kidding. I was fired today." Altimeter Group analyst Susan Ettlinger says quirkiness can be a great quality in the leader of a startup, but when it comes to running a public company, not so much.
When you're a startup founder, people expect and want a degree of inspiration. When you're the CEO of a public company, what people want is reassurance and continuity.
However, it may be hard for any new CEO of Groupon. Businesses that offer deals through Groupon discovered providing a discount to get someone in the door didn't necessarily turn them into a longtime customer.
It's giving you people who are looking for a cheaper alternative. That's not necessarily the people that you build a business on.
In his parting letter, former CEO Mason offers this wisdom: have the courage to start with the customer. But for Groupon, it's not clear if that's the people looking for the discount or the businesses offering one. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Tax day is looming, April 15th, and Steve, I don't know about you, but I am among those scrambling to gather receipts, W-2s, and other documents.
Oh, no, you can wait another, you know, weeks and weeks, more than a month before you get started with that.
Weeks and weeks before I have to start thinking about my tax extension. But whenever you do get around to it, there's plenty of software out there to help figure out how much you owe to Uncle Sam or how much Uncle Sam owes you. For more about helpful tax technologies, we reach Toby Stanger. She's a senior editor for personal finance for Consumer Reports. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
With many people preparing taxes on their own now, because of course they have all these tools, where does one go, though, to start? Where do you go to even find out what's out there?
Well, if you expect to have adjusted gross income of $57,000 or less, the easiest thing to do is to go to the IRS website, and they have a free section called Free File, and you can prepare and file your federal income taxes for free with one of 15 companies that has signed up with Free File. So you go to IRS, you click on Free File. If you think you're going to be have an adjusted gross income that's greater than that, you can use a search engine and just type in tax preparation. And a number of names should come up. One that everybody might know is TurboTax. H&R Block has its own online version. And TaxAct is a good one because everybody can file their federal return for free.
Give us some examples of the best and most helpful online tools.
Some of the tools that are quite interesting are charitable deduction trackers. There's something called It's Deductible. It's with TurboTax, but you can also use it online even if you don't use TurboTax. If you have receipts throughout the year, there's something called Shoebox. You actually send them your receipts, and they scan the documents for you and upload it so that you can then download it into your tax software or use it however you want.
In the last couple of years, we've been hearing about a rise in identity theft related mm-hmm. to online filing, such as mm-hmm. using someone's name and Social Security to steal their refund check. What about these tax prep sites? Do they make one more vulnerable to identity theft?
Well, they say they use bank-level security encryption. If you're comfortable with online banking, you can be comfortable filing your taxes online. If you find that you have trouble getting your refund because the IRS tells you that somebody else took it, you should definitely contact the IRS right away. If it were earlier in the season, I would say that filing early can help, because what identity thieves are doing is they're taking advantage of people who haven't yet filed. So for next year, file early so that you wouldn't be vulnerable in that way.
So what do you use?
I use TurboTax, and I do itemize my deductions. I use Mint, which is an online product that is free, and I can sort out my charitable deductions that way. There are other online products that do the same thing.
What other tips do you have for those who are willing to do it themselves and go online that'll make it easier for them to file?
Well, if you have mobile phone technology, there are apps to file a 1040EZ, which is the simple, very simple form, through TurboTax or H&R Block at home. You can photograph your W-2 from your smartphone, and it will import your information directly into your 1040EZ. And it goes right up into your return, and then you can file it directly from your smartphone, or you can go online and do it.
In the end, how would you judge these new online technologies? Are they, in fact, making it easier for individuals to prepare and file their tax returns?
Well, Consumer Reports hasn't tested all of these, but just from my looking at them in general, there's a lot that's out there to make tax preparation easier, more efficient, less scary. And people should take advantage of it and not be afraid to try doing it yourself, because you could save yourself $200, $600. It's worth trying. And you can try it for free. So what the heck?
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
Toby Stenger is a personal finance editor for Consumer Reports. For more tools and tips on filing your taxes, you can go to npr.org.
Switching gears now to another part of the world and another time, if you saw the Oscar-winning film Argo, that might have gotten you thinking about Iran. That movie took us back to a dangerous period of political unrest, and of course the country remains in the headlines because of concerns about a rising nuclear threat. But while all that is true, it's not the whole truth. The country has given roots to such diverse cultural figures as the beloved 13th century poet Rumi, the up-to-the-minute comedian Tehran Van Gostry, and authors like Firouzeh Dumas and the founder of eBay, Pierre Omidyar, have Iranian roots. Now, here at Tell Me More, a name you hear every week in our list of credits, our own senior producer, Iran Devar Ardalan, has decided to tell these stories in a new digital book. It's titled The Persian Square. It explores many of the major figures in Iran's history with interactive video, art, and of course, audio. And Devar is with us in the studio now. Thank you so much for walking down the hall to talk with us.
Thanks so much, Michelle.
This isn't your first book. You wrote a straightforward memoir in 2007. So why this topic and why this format?
Well, I thought it was important to create a digital space. You know, many who came here in 1979 were living in exile, and they weren't sure how long they would stay here. And it seemed 30 years on after the revolution that there was an opportunity to see who this community has become, who are Iranian Americans. And the digital space lent itself to that really well. I've loved being able to put together like a little carpet, a little, you know, multi-touch tapestry of a little bit of this person's voice, that person's voice, and putting together a bigger picture of who Iranian Americans are in this country.
I want to talk a little bit more about the audio, but I do want to talk about the stories. I'll just play this short clip and you can tell us who this is. Here it is.
I went to Iran many years ago as the wife of an Iranian physician, and I have lived off and on in Iran since 1931, so that I have become very much attached to the country.
And that's a name, that's a voice that you know very well. Who's that?
That's my grandmother, Helen Jeffries Bakhtiar, and she met my grandfather when she was 22 years old in Harlem, New York. She was a nurse, he was a doctor at Harlem Hospital, and he would take her to Coney Island and read her Persian poetry and kind of mesmerized her, and she fell in love with Persian culture. The two of them went back to Iran together in 1931, opened one of the first private hospitals, and she is an example of an early Iranian-American.
I'm interested in your decision about how to talk about your own family and how much to talk about your own family, because we live in a time when many people are encouraged to be and are very out loud and proud about their ethnic roots. But it's also true that this is a part of the world that many people have ambivalence about, that, you know, we know for a fact that, say, during the revolution, it was not an easy time to be an Iranian-American if you had a name that was Persian. I just wondered, was there any hesitation on your part? Did you ever think maybe this isn't such a great thing to highlight your connection to this part of the world and to this story?
Well, I was 16 years old when I was in Boston during the hostage-taking crisis, and my name was Iran. And I felt completely ashamed and out of place. And honestly, just a year ago, I thought about whether there's another 16-year-old girl today in Los Angeles, in Ohio, in Wisconsin, who is Iranian-American and who is ashamed of who she is. So this was an opportunity to be able to explore the rich cultural traditions that the two countries have had between one another and not so much try to hide behind it, because I'm almost 50 years old. And it's like, this might as well be my midlife crisis, you know, come to terms with the fact that I'm Iranian-American and be proud of it.
To that end, one of the interesting features of the book that I like, this is actually something that we at NPR avail ourselves of a lot. You have audio clips where people whom you've interviewed pronounce their names both in English and in the Persian way.
Sure.
Do you mind giving us your name in the Persian way?
Absolutely. So in Farsi, my name is pronounced Iran Davar Ardalan. And so in English, it's pronounced Iran Davar Ardalan. Like all different ethnic groups, we do grapple with how to present ourselves and our names. But I think that we also have to be understanding of the fact that not everybody can pronounce it the way of our birthplace.
Well, thank you for noticing that your English is so superior to my Farsi, so I will not attempt to pronounce it in Farsi. But the other advantage of the multimedia aspect of it is that you can hear music. You can hear music, you can hear poetry. I specifically want to play one song by a woman named Dr. Pardis Sabeti, and I'll play it. How was that? Did I do pretty well?
That
with
was
the
pretty good.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Nice.
And let me just play a short clip, and you can tell us a little bit about her.
All at once, then. Her voice was gone, as a daughter's soul passes on.
Tell us a little bit about this.
Sure. This is a song called Neda, and Dr. Pardis Sabeti wrote it in honor of Neda, the young woman who was killed in 2009 in the aftermath of the presidential elections. And she is a computational biologist. She studies evolutionary diseases at Harvard, but on the side, she's the lead singer of Thousand Days. And so I think that's part of what's exciting about this interactive format, is that you can be on the entry on her page reading about what she's doing at Harvard, but at the same time, you can tap on this song and swipe and pinch through the galleries and see her actually on stage performing.
Before we let you go, the title of the book is The Persian Square. Where does that title come from?
In February of 2010, the Los Angeles City Council designated the corner between Wilshire Boulevard and Wilkins Avenue in Los Angeles the Persian Square. And it was basically to honor the contributions of Persian businesses to Los Angeles, to the city of Los Angeles. The first business started on the corner of Wilshire and Wilkins in 1974. And so I've actually been asked by one of the city council members, press officers, whether I would go and have an event at the Persian Square with my iPad. So I'm waiting to see if that'll come together.
That was NPR senior producer Iran Davar Ardalan. She is talking about her new digital book, The Persian Square. You can get it from the iBookstore starting today. And if you want a sneak peek, just head to our website at npr.org. Davar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.